Side 6. Chapter 14. In the morning, I drove on to Pennsylvania, 30 miles or so to the north. The Appalachian Trail runs for 230 miles in a northeasterly arc across the state, like the broad end of a slice of pie. I never met a hiker with a good word to say about the trail in Pennsylvania. It is, as someone told a National Geographic reporter in 1987, the place where boots go to die. During the last ice age, it experienced what geologists call a periglacial climate, a zone at the edge of an ice sheet characterized by frequent freeze-thaw cycles that fractured the rock. The result is mile upon mile of jagged, oddly angled slabs of stone strewn about in wobbly piles known to science as Felsenmere, literally sea of rocks. These require constant attentiveness if you are not to twist an ankle or sprawl on your face. Not a pleasant experience with 50 pounds of momentum on your back. Lots of people leave Pennsylvania limping and bruised. Pennsylvania also has what are reputed to be the meanest rattlesnakes anywhere along the trail, and the most unreliable water sources, particularly in high summer. The AT in the state passes through no national parks or forests, traverses no notable eminences, offers no particularly memorable vistas, is untouched by history. It is essentially just the central part of a very long, taxing haul between the South and New England. It is little wonder that most people dislike it. Oh, and it also has the very worst maps ever produced for hikers anywhere. The six sheets, maps is really much too strong a word for them, produced for Pennsylvania by a body called the Keystone Trails Association, are small, monochrome, appallingly printed, inadequately keyed, and astoundingly vague. In short, completely useless. Comically useless. Heartbreakingly useless. Dangerously useless. No one should be sent into a wilderness with maps this bad. I had this brought home to me with a certain weep-inducing force, as I stood in a car park in a place called Caledonia State Park, looking at a section of map that was simply a blurred smear of whorls, like a poorly taken thumbprint. A single contour line was interrupted by a printed number in microscopic type. The number said either 1800 or 1200. It wasn't possible to tell. But it didn't actually matter because there was no scale indicated anywhere. Nothing to denote the height interval from one contour line to the next, or whether the packed bands of lines indicated a steep climb or precipitous descent. Not one single thing, not one single thing, within the entire park and for some miles around was denoted. From where I stood, I could be 50 feet or 2 miles from the Appalachian Trail. In any direction, there was simply no telling. Foolishly, I had not looked at these maps before setting off from home. I had packed in a hurry, simply noted that I had the correct set, and stuck them in my pack. I looked through them all now with a sense of dismay, as you might a series of compromising pictures of a loved one. I had known all along that I was never going to walk across Pennsylvania. I had neither the time nor the spirit for it. But I had thought I might find some nice, circular walks that would give me something of the challenging flavor of the state without making me endlessly retrace my steps. It was clear now, looking through the complete set, that not only were there no circular hikes to be had, but it was going to be the next thing to pure luck any time I stumbled on the trail at all. Sighing, I put the maps away, and set off through the park on foot, looking for the familiar white blazes of the AT. It was a pleasant park in a wooded valley, quite empty on this fine morning. I walked for perhaps an hour along a network of winding paths through trees and over wooden footbridges, but I failed to find the AT. So I returned to the car and pushed on, along a lonely highway through the dense flying leaves of Michaux State Forest, and on to Pine Grove Furnace State Park, a large recreation area built around a 19th-century stone kiln, now a picturesque ruin from which it takes its name. The park had snack huts, picnic tables, and a lake with a swimming area, but all were shut, and there wasn't a soul about. On the edge of the picnic area was a big dumpster, with a sturdy metal lid that had been severely, arrestingly mangled and dented, and half wrenched from its hinges, presumably by a bear trying to get at park rubbish. I examined it with the deepest respect. I hadn't realized black bears were quite that strong. Here, at least, the AT blazes were prominent. They led around the lake and up through steep woods to the summit of Piney Mountain, which wasn't indicated on the map, and isn't really a mountain, since it barely rises to 1,500 feet. Still, it was challenging enough on a hot summer's day. Just outside the park, there is a board marking the traditional but entirely notional midpoint of the Appalachian Trail, with 1,080.2 indicated miles of hiking in either direction. Since no one can say exactly how long the AT is, the real midpoint could be anywhere within 50 miles or so. In any case, it would change from year to year because of reroutings. Two-thirds of through hikers never see it anyway, because they have dropped out by this point. It must actually be quite a depressing moment to have slogged through a mountainous wilderness for 10 or 11 weeks and to realize that for all that effort, you are still but halfway there. It was also round here that one of the trail's more notorious murders took place, the one at the heart of the book Eight Bullets, which I had bought at ATC headquarters the day before. The story is simply told. In May 1988, two young hikers, Rebecca White and Claudia Brenner, who were lesbians, excited the attention of a disturbed young man with a rifle, who shot them eight times from a distance as they made love in a leafy clearing beside the trail. White was killed. Brenner, seriously wounded, managed to stumble down the mountain to a road and was rescued by some passing teenagers in a pickup truck. The murderer was swiftly caught and convicted. The next year, a young man and woman were killed by a drifter at a shelter just a few miles to the north, which rather gave Pennsylvania a bad reputation for a while. But then there were no murders anywhere along the AT for 7 years, until the recent deaths of the two young women in Shenandoah National Park. Their deaths brought the official murder toll to 9, quite a large number for any footpath, no matter how you look at it, though in fact there probably have been more. Between 1946 and 1950, 3 people vanished while hiking through one small area of Vermont, but they aren't included in the tally, whether because it happened so long ago or because it was never conclusively proved that they were murdered, I couldn't say. I was also told by an acquaintance in New England of an older couple who were killed by a deranged axe murderer in Maine sometime in the 1970s. But again, it doesn't appear in any records because, evidently, they were on a side trail when they were attacked. I had read Eight Bullets, Brenner's account of the murder of her friend, overnight, so I was generally acquainted with the circumstances. But I intentionally left the book in the car as it seemed a little morbid to go looking for a death site nearly a decade after the event. I wasn't remotely spooked by the murder, but even so I felt a vague, low-grade unease at being alone in a silent wood so far from home. I missed Katz, missed his puffing and bitching and unflappable fearlessness, hated the thought that if I sat on a rock waiting he would never come. The woods were in full chlorophyll-choked glory now, which made them seem even more pressing and secretive. Often I couldn't see 5 feet into the dense foliage on either side of the path. If I did happen on a bear, I would be quite helpless. No cats would come along after a minute to smack it on the snout for me and say, "Jesus, Bryson, you caused me a lot of trouble." No one at all would come to share the excitement, it appeared. There didn't seem to be another person within 50 miles. The woods belonged to me, and whatever else was out there. So I walked the 3.5 miles to the top of Piney Mountain with a certain purposeful briskness. At the summit I stood uncertainly, unable to decide whether to go on a bit further or turn back and perhaps try somewhere else, when there was a dry crack of wood and a careless rustle of undergrowth perhaps 50 feet into the woods, something good-sized and unseen. I stopped everything, moving, breathing, thinking, and stood on tiptoe, peering into the leafy void. The noise came again, nearer. Whatever it was coming my way. Whimpering, quietly but sincerely, I ran 100 yards, daypack bouncing wildly, glasses jiggling, then turned, heart-stopped, and looked back. A deer, resplendently antlered, stepped onto the path, gazed at me for a moment without concern, and sauntered on. I took a long moment to catch my breath and wiped a river of sweat from my brow. I wasn't sure I was cut out for this sort of thing. I returned to the car without further incident. I stopped the night near Harrisburg, and in the morning drove north and east across the state on back highways, trying to follow the trail as closely as I could by road, and stopping once or twice, where possible, to sample the trail, but without finding anything that looked remotely rewarding, so mostly I drove. Pennsylvania is not an easy place to characterize, partly because it is big and populous, 400 miles across from east to west, 12 million inhabitants, and partly because it is such a peculiar, patternless mix of ugly, half-dead factory towns, sweet little college communities, rolling farmland, and industrially scarred hillsides, a place equally at home to Rocky Balboa, Dwight Eisenhower, Andrew Carnegie, and an Amish farmer. In the space of 5 miles, it can go from hideous to gorgeous, to hideous to more hideous, to gorgeous again. I know a man who bought an old farmhouse in a remote storybook vale as a weekend home. He awoke one Sunday to explosive booms and the tinkle of ceiling plaster, and discovered that a gravel company was quarrying right up to his property line. He sold the house at a staggering loss, bought another even more remote property, and awoke there to the sound of a phalanx of bulldozers preparing the farmland next door for a giant polypropylene plant. So he moved to Virginia. But that's Pennsylvania for you. I passed through a long, tight valley, enclosed by dark hills. Every farm on both sides of the road grew Christmas trees, endless, genetically identical rows of them that presented an infinite variety of straight lines from whatever angle you viewed them. At the end of each drive, there was a mailbox with a name neatly lettered on the side, and every name without exception sounded comical and made up. Pritz, Putz, Moots, Snoots, Schleppel, Klutz, Kuntz, Kunkel. And the scattered towns were just the same, but for the addition of a place suffix. Funksville, Crumsville, Kutztown. Then, little by little, the town names began to take on a frank, industrial tone. Port Carbon, Minersville, Lehigh Furnace, Slatedale. And I realized I was entering the strange, half-forgotten world of Pennsylvania's anthracite region. At Minersville, I turned onto a back highway and headed through a landscape of overgrown slag heaps and rusting machinery towards Centralia, the strangest, saddest town I believe I have ever seen. Eastern Pennsylvania sits on one of the richest coal beds on earth. Almost from the moment Europeans arrived, they realized there was coal out there in quantities almost beyond conception. The trouble was it was virtually all anthracite, a coal so immensely hard, it is 95% carbon, that for a very long time no one could figure out how to get it to light. It wasn't until 1828 that an enterprising Scot named James Neilson had the simple but effective idea of injecting heated air, rather than cold air, into an iron furnace by means of a bellows. The process became known as a hot blast, and it transformed the coal industry all over the world. Wales, too, had a lot of anthracite, but especially in the United States. By the end of the century, America was producing 300 million tons of coal a year, about as much as the rest of the world put together. And the great bulk of it came from Pennsylvania's anthracite belt. Meanwhile, to its intense gratification, Pennsylvania had also discovered oil. Not only discovered it, but devised ways to make it industrially useful. Petroleum, or rock oil, had been a curiosity of western Pennsylvania for years. It emerged in seeps along riverbanks, where it was blotted up with blankets to be made into patent medicines, esteemed for their value to cure everything from scrofula to diarrhea. In 1859, a mysterious figure named Colonel Edwin Drake, who wasn't a colonel at all, but a retired railway conductor with no understanding of geology, developed from goodness knows where the belief that oil could be extracted from the ground via wells. At Titusville, he bored a hole to a depth of 69 feet and got the world's first gusher. Quickly, it was realized that petroleum and volume could be not just used to bind bowels and banish scabby growths, but refined into lucrative products like paraffin and kerosene. Western Pennsylvania boomed inordinately. In 3 months, as John McPhee notes in Suspect Terrain, the endearingly named Pithole City went from a population of zero to 15,000. And other towns throughout the region sprang up. Oil City, Petroleum Center, Red Hot. John Wilkes Booth came and lost his savings, then went off to kill a president. But others stayed and made a fortune. For one lively half-century, Pennsylvania had a virtual monopoly on one of the most valuable products in the world, oil, and an overwhelmingly dominant role in the production of a second, coal. Because of the proximity of rich supplies of fuel, the state became the center of big, fuel-intensive industries like steelmaking and chemicals. Lots of people became colossally rich. But not the mine workers. Mining has, of course, always been a wretched line of work everywhere, but nowhere more so than in the United States in the second half of the 19th century. Thanks to immigration, miners were infinitely expendable. When the Welsh got bolshy, you brought in Irish. When they failed to satisfy, you brought in Italians or Poles or Hungarians. Workers were paid by the ton, which meant not only that they were given an incentive to hack out coal with reckless haste, but also that any labor they expended making their environment safer or more comfortable went uncompensated. Mine shafts were bored through the earth like holes through Swiss cheese, often destabilizing whole valleys. In 1846, at Carbondale, almost 50 acres of mine shafts collapsed simultaneously without warning, claiming hundreds of lives. Explosions and flash fires were common. Mine dust is incredibly volatile, and most of this at a time, remember, when the only illumination was open flames. Between 1870 and the outbreak of the First World War, 50,000 people died in American mines. The great irony of anthracite is that tough as it is to light, once you get it lit, it's nearly impossible to put out. Stories of uncontrolled mine fires are legion in eastern Pennsylvania. One fire at Lehigh began in 1850 and didn't burn itself out until the Great Depression, 80 years after it started. And thus, we come to Centralia. For a century, Centralia was a sturdy little pit community. However difficult life may have been for the early miners, by the second half of the 20th century, Centralia was a reasonably prosperous, snug, hard-working town with a population approaching 2,000. It had a thriving business district with banks and a post office, and the normal range of shops and small department stores, a high school, four churches, an Oddfellows Club, a town hall. In short, a typical, pleasant, contentedly anonymous, small American town. Unfortunately, it also sat on 24 million tons of anthracite. In 1962, a fire in a tip on the edge of town ignited a coal seam. The fire department poured thousands of gallons of water onto the fire, but each time they seemed to have it extinguished, it came back, like those trick birthday candles that go out for a moment and then spontaneously reignite. And then, very slowly, the fire began to eat its way along the subterranean seams. Smoke began to rise eerily from the ground over a wide area, like steam off a lake at dawn. On Highway 61, the asphalt grew warm to the touch, then began to crack and settle, rendering the road unusable. The smoking zone passed under the highway and fanned out through a neighboring woodland and up towards St. Ignatius Catholic Church on a knoll above the town. The U.S. Bureau of Mines brought in experts who proposed any number of possible remedies, digging a deep trench through the town, deflecting the course of the fire with explosives, flushing the whole thing out hydraulically, but the cheapest proposal would have cost at least $20 million, with no guarantee that it would work. And in any case, no one was empowered to spend that kind of money. So the fire slowly burned on. In 1979, the owner of a petrol station near the center of town found that the temperature in his underground tanks was registering 172 degrees Fahrenheit. Sensors sunk into the earth showed that the temperature 13 feet under the tanks was almost 1,000 degrees. Elsewhere, people were discovering that their cellar walls and floor were hot to the touch. Smoke by now was seeping from the ground all over town, and people were beginning to grow nauseated and faint from the increased levels of carbon dioxide in their homes. In 1981, a 12-year-old boy was playing in his grandmother's back garden when a plume of smoke suddenly appeared in front of him. As he stared at it, the ground opened around him. He clung to tree roots until someone heard his calls and hauled him out. The hole was found to be 80 feet deep. Within days, similar cave-ins were appearing all over town. It was about then that people started getting serious about the fire. The federal government came up with $42 million to evacuate the town. As people moved out, their houses were bulldozed, and the rubble was neatly, fastidiously cleared away until there were almost no buildings remaining. So today, Centralia isn't really even a ghost town. It's just a big, open space with a grid of empty streets still surreally furnished with stop signs and fire hydrants. Every 30 feet or so, there is a neat, paved driveway going 15 or 20 yards to nowhere. There are still a few houses scattered around, all of them modest, narrow, wood-frame structures stabilized with brick buttresses, and a couple of buildings in what was once the central business district. I parked outside a building with a faded sign that said, rather grandly, Centralia Mine Fire Project Office of the Columbia Redevelopment Authority. The building was boarded and all but falling down. Next door was another in better shape called Speed Stop Car Parts, overlooking a neatly groomed park with an American flag on a pole beside a bench. The shop appeared to be still in business, but the interior was darkened and there was no one around. There was no one anywhere, come to that. No passing traffic, not a sound but the lazy clank of a metal ring knocking against the flagpole. Here and there in the vacant lots were metal cylinders like oil drums that had been fixed in the ground and were silently venting smoke. Up a slight slope, across an expanse of vacant lots, a modern church, quite large, stood in a lazy pall of white smoke. St. Ignatius, I assumed. I walked up. The church looked sound and usable. The windows were not boarded, and there were no keep-out signs. But it was locked, and there was no board announcing services or anything even to indicate its name or denomination. All around it, smoke was hovering wispily off the ground. But just behind it, great volumes of smoke were billowing from the earth over a large area. I walked over and found myself on the lip of a vast cauldron, perhaps an acre in extent, which was emitting thick, cloud-like, pure white smoke, the kind of smoke you get from burning tires or old blankets. It was impossible to tell, through the stew of smoke, how deep the hole was. The ground felt warm and was loosely covered in a fine ash. I walked back to the front of the church. A heavy metal crash barrier stood across the old road, and a new highway curved off down a hillside away from the town. I stepped round the barrier and walked down old Highway 61. Clumps of weedy grass poked through the surface here and there, but it still looked a serviceable road. All around, on both sides, for a considerable distance, the land smoked broodingly, like the aftermath of a forest fire. About 50 yards along, a jagged crack appeared down the center of the highway and quickly grew into a severe gash several inches across, emitting still more smoke. In places, the road on one side of the gash had subsided a foot or more, or slumped into a shallow, bowl-shaped depression. From time to time, I peered into the crack, but couldn't gauge anything of its depth for the swirling smoke, which proved to be disagreeably acrid and sulfurous when the breeze pushed it over me. I walked along for some minutes, gravely examining the scar as if I were some kind of official inspector of highways, before I spread my gaze more generally, and it dawned on me that I was in the middle, very much in the middle, of an extensively smoking landscape. on possibly no more than a skin of asphalt, above a fire that had been burning out of control for 34 years. Not, I'm bound to say, the smartest place in North America to position oneself. Perhaps it was no more than a literally heated imagination, but the ground suddenly seemed distinctly spongy and resilient, as if I were walking across a mattress. I retreated in haste to the car. It seemed odd, on reflection, that I or any other severely foolish person could drive in and have a look around a place as patently dangerous and unstable as Centralia, and yet there was nothing to stop anyone from venturing anywhere. What was odder still was that the evacuation of Centralia was not total. Those who wanted to stay and live with the possibility of having their houses fall into the earth were allowed to remain, and a few had evidently so chosen. I got back in the car and drove up to a lone house in the center of town. The house, painted a pale green, was eerily neat and well-maintained. A vase of artificial flowers and other modest decorative knick-knacks stood on a windowsill, and there was a bed of marigolds by the freshly painted stoop, but there was no car in the drive, and no one answered the bell. Several of the other houses proved on closer inspection to be unoccupied. Two were boarded and had danger keep-out notices tacked to them. Five or six others, including a clutch of three on the far side of the Central Park, were still evidently lived in. One, amazingly, even had children's toys in the garden. Who on earth would keep children in a place like this? But there was no answer at any of the bells I tried. Everyone was either at work, or, for all I knew, lying dead on the kitchen floor. It seemed exceedingly odd that people would be permitted to remain here. But then, America is a strange country where personal liberty is concerned. At one house I knocked at, I fancied I saw a curtain move, but I couldn't be sure. Who knows how crazy these people might be after 3 decades of living on top of an inferno and breathing head-lightening quantities of CO2, or how weary they might have grown of outsiders cheerfully poking around and treating their town as a curious diversion. I was privately relieved that no one answered my knocks, because I couldn't for the life of me think what my opening question would be. It was well past lunchtime, so I drove the 5 miles or so to Mount Carmel, the nearest town. Mount Carmel was mildly startling after Centralia, a busy little town, nicely old-fashioned, with traffic on Main Street and sidewalks full of shoppers and other townsfolk going about their business. I had lunch at the Academy Luncheonette and Sporting Goods Store, possibly the only place in America where you can gaze at jockstraps while eating a tuna salad sandwich, and was intending then to push on in search of the AT, but on the way back to the car, I passed a public library and impulsively popped in to ask if they had any information on Centralia. They did. 3 fat files, bulging with newspaper and magazine cuttings, most dating from 1979 to 81, when Centralia briefly attracted national attention, particularly after the little boy, one Todd Dombowski, was nearly swallowed by the earth in his granny's garden. There was also, quite poignantly now, a slender case-bound history of Centralia, prepared to mark the town's centenary just before the outbreak of the fire. It was full of photographs showing a bustling town, not at all unlike the one that stood just outside the library door, but with a difference of 30-some years. I had forgotten just how distant the 1960s have grown. All the men in the photograph wore hats. The women and girls were in billowy skirts. All, of course, were happily unaware that their pleasant, anonymous town was quite doomed. It was nearly impossible to connect the busy place in the photographs to the empty space from which I had just come. As I put the things back in their folders, a cutting fluttered to the floor. It was an article from Newsweek. Someone had underlined a short paragraph towards the end of the article and put 3 exclamation marks in the margin. It was a quote from a mine fire authority, observing that if the rate of burning held steady, there was enough coal under Centralia to burn for 1,000 years. It happened that a few miles beyond Centralia, there was another scene of unusual devastation that I had heard about and was keen to investigate. A mountainside in the Lehigh Valley that had been so lavishly polluted by a zinc mill that it had been entirely stripped of vegetation. I had heard about it from John Connolly, who recalled it as being near Palmerton, so I drove there the following morning. Palmerton was a good-sized town, grimy and industrial, but not without its finer points. A couple of solid turn-of-the-century civic buildings that gave it an air of consequence, a dignified central square, and a business district that was clearly depressed but gamely clinging to life. The background was dominated everywhere by big, prison-like factories, all of which appeared to be redundant. At one end of town, I spotted what I had come to find, a steep, broad eminence, perhaps 1,500 feet high and several miles long, which was almost entirely naked of vegetation. There was a car park beside the road, and a factory 100 yards or so beyond. I pulled into the car park and got out to gawp. It truly was an arresting sight. As I stood there, some fat guy in a uniform stepped out of a security booth and waddled towards me, looking cross and officious. "The hell you think you're doing?" he barked. "Pardon me," I replied, taken aback. And then, "I'm looking at that hill." "You can't do that." "I can't look at a hill?"
"Not here you can't. This is private property."
"I'm sorry, I didn't know."
"Well, it's private, like the sign says."
He indicated a post that was in fact signless and looked momentarily struck.
"Well, it's private," he added.
"I'm sorry, I didn't know," I said again, not appreciating yet how keenly this man took his responsibilities. I was still marveling at the hill. "That's an amazing sight, isn't it?" I said.
"What is?"
"That mountain. There isn't a scrap of vegetation on it."
"I wouldn't know. I'm not paid to look at hillsides."
"Well, you should look sometime. I think you'd be surprised." "So is that the zinc factory, then?" I said, with a nod at the complex of buildings over his left shoulder. He regarded me suspiciously.
"What do you want to know for?"
I returned his stare. "I'm out of zinc," I replied. He gave me a sideways look, as if to say, "Oh, a wise guy, huh?" and said suddenly, decisively,
"I think maybe I'd better take your name."
With difficulty, he extracted a notebook and a stubby pencil from a back pocket. "What, because I asked you if that was a zinc factory?"
"Because you're trespassing on private property."
"I didn't know I was trespassing. You don't even have a sign up." He had his pencil poised.
"Name?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
"Sir, you are trespassing on private property. Now, are you going to tell me your name?"
"No." We went through a little back and forth along these lines for a minute. At last he shook his head regretfully and said,
"Play it your way, then."
He dragged out some communication device, pulled up an antenna, and got it to operate. Too late, I realized that for all his air of exasperation, this was a moment he had dreamed of during many long, uneventful shifts in his little glass booth.
"J.D.," he said into the receiver, "Luther here. You got the clamps? I got an infractor in Lot A."
"What are you doing?"
"I'm impounding your vehicle."
"Don't be ridiculous.
I only pulled off the road for a minute. Look, I'm going, okay?"
I got in the car, started the engine, and made to go forward, but he blocked the way. I leaned from the window.
"Excuse me," I called,
but he didn't move. He just stood with his back to me and his arms crossed, conspicuously disregarding me. I tooted the horn, lightly, but he was not to be shifted. I put my head out of the window and said,
"All right, I'll tell you my name, then. It's too late for that."
"Oh, for God's sake," I muttered, and then out of the window,
"Please?"
And then whinily, "Come on, buddy, please?" But he had set a course and was not to be deflected. I leaned out once more.
"Tell me, did they specify asshole on the job description, or did you go on a course?"
Then I breathed a very bad word and sat and steamed. 30 seconds later, a car pulled up, and a man in sunglasses got out. He was wearing the same uniform, but was 10 or 15 years older, and a whole lot trimmer. He had the bearing of a drill sergeant.
"Problem here?" he said, looking from one to the other of us.
"Perhaps you can help me," I said in a tone of sweet reason. "I'm looking for the Appalachian Trail. This gentleman here tells me I'm trespassing."
"He was looking at the hill, J.D.,"
the fat guy protested a little hotly. But J.D. raised a palm to still him, then turned to me.
"You a hiker?"
"Yes, sir."
I indicated the pack on the back seat. I just wanted directions, and the next thing I know, I gave a cheerful, dismayed laugh, this man's telling me I'm on private property and he's impounding my car.
J.D., the man was looking at the hill and asking questions.
But J.D. held up another calming hand.
Where are you hiking?
I told him. He nodded.
Well, then you want to go up the road about 4 miles to Little Gap and take the right for Danielsville. At the top of the hill, you'll see the trail crossing. You can't miss it.
Thank you very much.
Not a problem. You have a good hike, you hear?
I thanked him again and drove off. In the rearview mirror, I noticed, with gratification, that he was remonstrating quietly but firmly with Luther, threatening, I very much hoped, to take his communication device away. The route went steeply up to a lonesome pass, where there was a dirt car park. I parked, found the AT, and walked along it on a high, exposed ridge through the most amazingly devastated terrain. For miles, it was either entirely barren or covered in the spindly trunks of dead trees, a few still weakly standing, but most toppled. It brought to mind a First World War battlefield after heavy shelling. The ground was covered in a gritty black dust, like iron filings. The walking was uncommonly easy. The ridge was almost perfectly flat, and the absence of vegetation meant that there were boundless views. All the other visible hills, including those facing me across the narrow valley, looked to be in good health, except where they had been scarred and gouged by quarrying or strip mining, which was regularly. I walked for a little over an hour, until I came to a sudden, almost absurdly steep descent to Lehigh Gap, almost 1,000 feet straight down, or, of course, straight up for those coming from the other direction, gave small thanks that I didn't have to do either, and trudged back to the car the way I had come. It was almost 4 o'clock when I got back to the car. The afternoon was as good as shot. I had driven 350 miles to get to Pennsylvania, had spent 4 long days in the state, and walked a net 11 miles of the Appalachian Trail. Never again, I vowed, would I try to hike the Appalachian Trail with a car. Still, I did have the deep and lasting satisfaction of having got a fat guy named Luther in trouble. I have had worse trips. Chapter 15. Once, eons ago, the Appalachians were of a scale and majesty to rival the Himalayas, piercing, snow-peaked, pushing breathtakingly through the clouds to heights of 4 miles or more. New Hampshire's Mount Washington is still an imposing presence, but the stony mass that rises above the New England woods today represents at most the stubby bottom one-third of what was 10 million years ago. That the Appalachian Mountains present so much more modest an aspect today is because they have had so much time in which to wear away. The Appalachians are immensely old, older than the oceans and continents, far, far older than most other mountain chains. When simple plants colonized the land and the first creatures crawled blinking from the sea, the Appalachians were there. They are, in fact, among the oldest landscape features on Earth. Something over 1 billion years ago, the continents of Earth were a single mass called Pangaea, surrounded by the lonely Panthalassan Sea. Then some unexplained turmoil within the Earth's mantle caused the land to break apart and drift off as vast asymmetrical chunks. From time to time over the ages since, 3 times at least, the continents have held a kind of grand reunion, floating back to some central spot and bumping together with slow but crushing force. It was during the third of these collisions, starting about 470 million years ago, that the Appalachians were first pushed up, like a rucked carpet, as the analogy nearly always has it. 470 million years is a mind-dulling number. But if you can imagine flying backwards through time at a rate of 1 year per second, it would take you about 16 years to cover such a span. It's a long time. The continents didn't just move in and out from each other in some kind of grand slow-motion square dance, but spun in lazy circles, changed their orientation, went on cruises to the tropics and poles, made friends with smaller land masses and brought them home. Florida once belonged to Africa. A corner of Staten Island is geologically part of Europe. The seaboard from New England up to Canada appears to have originated in Morocco. Parts of Greenland, Ireland, Scotland, and Scandinavia have the same rocks as the eastern United States, are in effect ruptured outposts of the Appalachians. There are even suggestions that mountains as far south as the Shackleton Range in Antarctica may be fragments of the Appalachian family. The Appalachians were formed in three long phases, or orogenies, as scientists like to call them, known as the Taconic, Acadian, and Alleghenian. The first two were essentially responsible for the northern Appalachians, the third for the central and southern Appalachians. As the continents bumped and nudged, sometimes one continental plate would slide over another, pushing ocean floor before it, reworking the landscape for 150 miles or more inland. At other times, it would plunge beneath, stirring up the mantle and resulting in long spells of volcanic activity and earthquakes. Sometimes the collisions would interleave layers of rock like shuffled playing cards. It is tempting to think of this as some kind of giant, continent-sized car crash, but of course it happened with imperceptible slowness. The Proto-Atlantic Ocean, sometimes more romantically called Iapetus, which filled the void between continents during one of the early splits, looks in most textbook illustrations like a transitory puddle. There in Figure 9A, vanished in Figure 9B, as if the sun had come out for a day or so and dried it up. Yet it existed far longer, hundreds of millions of years longer, than our own Atlantic has. So it was with the formation of mountains. If you were to travel back to one of the mountain-building phases of the Appalachians, you wouldn't be aware of anything geologically grand going on, any more than we are sensible now that India is plowing into Asia like a runaway truck into a snowbank, pushing the Himalayas up by a millimeter or so a year. And as soon as the mountains were built, they began, just as ineluctably, to wear away. For all their seeming permanence, mountains are exceedingly transitory features. In Meditations at 10,000 Feet, the writer and geologist James Treffel calculates that a typical mountain stream will carry away about 1,000 cubic feet of mountain in a year, mostly in the form of sand granules and other suspended particles. That is equivalent to the capacity of an average-sized dump truck. Clearly not much at all. Imagine a dump truck arriving once each year at the base of a mountain, filling up with a single load and driving off, not to reappear for another 12 months. At such a rate, it seems impossible that it could ever cart away a mountain. But in fact, given sufficient time, that is precisely what would happen. Assuming a mountain 5,000 feet high, with 500,000 million cubic feet of mass, roughly the size of Mount Washington, a single stream would level it in about 500 million years. Of course, most mountains have several streams, and moreover are exposed to a vast range of other reductive factors, from the infinitesimal acidic secretions of lichen, tiny but relentless, to the grinding scrape of ice sheets. So most mountains vanish very much more quickly, in a couple of 100 million years, say. Right now, the Appalachians are shrinking on average by 0.03 millimeters per year. They have gone through this cycle at least twice, possibly more, rising to awesome heights, eroding away to nothingness, rising again, each time recycling their component materials in a dazzlingly confused and complex geology. The detail of all this is theory, you understand. Very little of it is more than generally agreed upon. Some scientists believe the Appalachians experienced a fourth, earlier mountain-building episode called the Grenville Orogeny, and that there may have been others earlier still. Likewise, Pangaea may have split and reformed not three times, but a dozen times, or perhaps a score of times. On top of all this, there are a number of lapses in the theory, chief of which is that there is little direct evidence of continental collisions, which is odd, even inexplicable, if you accept that at least three continents rubbed together with enormous force for a period of at least 150 million years. There ought to be a suture, a, a layer of scar tissue stretching up the eastern seaboard of the United States. There isn't. I am no geologist, God knows. Show me an unusual piece of gray wacky or a handsome chunk of gabbro, and I will regard it with respect and listen politely to what you have to say, but it won't actually mean anything to me. If you tell me that once it was seafloor ooze, and that through some incredible sustained process it was thrust deep into the earth, baked and squeezed for millions of years, then popped back onto the surface, which is what accounts for its magnificent striations, its vitreous crystals, and flaky biotite mica, I will say, goodness, and is that a fact? But I can't pretend that anything actually will be going on behind my game expression. Just occasionally am I permitted an appreciative glimpse into the wonder that is geology, and such a place is the Delaware Water Gap. There, above the serene and stately Delaware River, stands Kittatinny Mountain, a wall of rock 1,300 feet high, consisting of resistant quartzite, or so it says here, that was exposed when the river cut a passage through softer rock on its quiet, steady progress to the sea. The result, in effect, is a cross-section of mountain, which is not a view you get every day, or indeed anywhere else along the Appalachian Trail that I am aware of, and here it is particularly impressive because the exposed quartzite is arrayed in long, wavery bands that lie at such an improbably canted angle, about 45 degrees, as to suggest to even the dullest imagination that something very big, geologically speaking, happened here. It is a very fine view. A century or so ago, people compared it to the Rhine, and even, a little ambitiously, I'm bound to say, the Alps. The artist George Innes came and made a famous painting called Delaware Water Gap. It shows the river rolling lazily between meadowy fields dotted with trees and farms, against a distant backdrop of sere hills, notched with a V where the river passes through. It looks like a piece of Yorkshire or Cumbria transplanted to the American continent. In the 1850s, a plush 250-room hotel called Kittatinny House rose on the banks of the river, and was such a success that others soon followed. For a generation after the Civil War, the Delaware Water Gap was the place to be in summer. Then, as is always the way with these things, the White Mountains came into fashion. Then Niagara Falls, then the Catskills, then the Disneys. Now, almost no one comes to the Water Gap to stay. People still pass through in large numbers, but they park in a lay-by, have a brief appreciative gaze, then get back in their cars and drive off. Today, alas, you have to squint, and pretty hard at that, to get any notion of the tranquil beauty that attracted Innes. The Water Gap is not only the nearest thing to spectacle in eastern Pennsylvania, but the only usable breach in the Appalachians in the area of the Poconos. In consequence, its narrow shelf of usable land is packed with state and local roads, a railway line, and an interstate highway, with a long, heartbreakingly uninteresting concrete bridge carrying the streams of humming trucks and cars between Pennsylvania and New Jersey, the whole suggesting, as John McPhee neatly put it in Suspect Terrain, a convergence of tubes leading to a patient in intensive care. Still, Kittatinny Mountain, towering above the river on the New Jersey side, is a compelling sight, and you can't look at it, at least I couldn't, at least not this day, without wanting to climb it and see what is up there. I parked at an information center at its base and set off into the welcoming green woods. It was a gorgeous morning, dewy and cool, but with a kind of sunshine and sluggish air that promises a lot of heat later on, and I was early enough to be able to get a decent day's walk in. I was gratified to find that I was really looking forward to this. I was on the edge of several thousand acres of very pretty woodlands, shared jointly by Worthington State Forest and the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area. The path was well maintained, and just steep enough to feel like healthful exercise rather than some kind of obsessive torture. And here was a final joyful bonus. I had excellent maps. I was now in the cartographically thoughtful hands of the New York New Jersey Trail Conference, whose maps are richly printed in four colors, with green for woodland, blue for water, red for trails, and black for lettering. They are clearly and generously labeled and sensibly scaled, 1 to 36,000. And they include in full all connecting roads and side trails. It is as if they want you to know where you are and to take pleasure in knowing it. I can't tell you what a satisfaction it is to be able to say, "Ah, Dunfield Creek, I see." And so that must be Shawnee Island down there. If all the AT maps were anything like as good as this, I would have enjoyed the experience appreciably more, say 25% more. It occurred to me now that a great part of my mindless indifference to my surroundings earlier on was simply that I didn't know where I was, couldn't know where I was. Now, for once, I could take my bearings, perceive my future, feel as if I was somehow in touch with a changing and knowable landscape. And so I walked 5 thoroughly agreeable miles up Kittatinny to Sunfish Pond, a very comely 41-acre pond surrounded by woods. Along the way, I encountered just 2 other people, both day hikers, and I thought again what a stretch it is to suggest that the Appalachian Trail is too crowded. Something like 30 million people live within an hour's drive of the water gap. New York is just 45 miles to the east, Philadelphia a little bit more to the south. And it was a flawless summer's day, and the whole of these majestic woods belonged to just 3 of us. For northbound hikers, Sunfish Pond is something of a glorious novelty, since nowhere south of here will you find a body of water on a mountaintop. It is, in fact, the first glacial feature northbound hikers come across. During the last ice age, this was about as far as the ice sheets got. The furthest advance in New Jersey was about 10 miles south of the water gap, though even here, where the climate would let it go no further, it was still at least 2,000 feet thick. Imagine that! A wall of ice nearly 0.5 mile high, and beyond it, for thousands of square miles, nothing but more ice, broken only by the peaks of a very few of the loftiest mountains. What a sight that must have been! And here is the thing. We are still in an ice age. Only now we experience it for just part of the year. Snow and ice and cold are not really typical features of planet Earth. Taking the long view, Antarctica is actually a jungle. It's just having a chilly spell. At the very peak of the last ice age, 20,000 years ago, 30% of Earth was under ice. Today, 10% still is. There have been at least 12 ice ages in the last 2 million years, each lasting in the neighborhood of 100,000 years. The force of them is quite staggering. The most recent intrusion, called the Wisconsinian ice sheet, spread down from the polar regions over much of Europe and North America, growing to depths of up to 2 miles and advancing at an estimated rate of 200 to 400 feet a year. As it soaked up the Earth's free water, sea levels fell by 450 feet. Then, about 10,000 years ago, not abruptly exactly, but near enough, it began to melt back. No one knows why. What it left in its wake was a landscape utterly transformed. It dumped Long Island, Cape Cod, Nantucket, and most of Martha's Vineyard, where previously there had just been sea. And it gouged out the Great Lakes, Hudson Bay, and Little Sunfish Pond, among much else. Every foot of the landscape from here on north would be scored and scarred with reminders of glaciation. Scattered boulders called erratics, drumlins, eskers, V-shaped valleys, high tarns. I was entering a new world. No one knows much of anything about Earth's many ice ages, why they came, why they stopped, when they may return. One interesting theory, given our present-day concerns with global warming, is that the ice ages were caused not by falling temperatures, but by rising ones. Warm weather would increase precipitation, which would increase cloud cover, which would lead to less snowmelt at higher elevations. You don't need a great deal of bad weather to get an ice age. As Gwen Schultz notes in Ice Age Lost, it is not necessarily the amount of snow that causes ice sheets, but the fact that snow, however little, lasts. In terms of precipitation, she observes, Antarctica is the driest large area on Earth, drier overall than any large desert. Here's another interesting thought. If glaciers started reforming, they would have a great deal more water now to draw on. Hudson Bay, the Great Lakes, the hundreds of thousands of lakes of Canada, none of which existed to fuel the last ice sheet. So, they would grow much more quickly. And if they did start to advance again, what exactly would we do? Blast them with TNT? Or maybe nuclear warheads? Well, doubtless we would, but consider this. In 1964, the largest earthquake ever recorded in North America rocked Alaska with 200,000 megatons of concentrated might, the equivalent of 2,000 nuclear bombs. Almost 3,000 miles away in Texas, water sloshed out of swimming pools. A street in Anchorage fell 20 feet. The quake devastated 24,000 square miles of wilderness, much of it glaciated. And what effect did all this might have on Alaska's glaciers? None. Just beyond the pond was a side trail, the Garvey Springs Trail, which descended very steeply to an old paved road along the river, just below a spot called Tox Island, which would take me in a lazy loop back towards the visitor center where I had left the car. It was 4 miles, and the day was growing warm, but the road was shaded and quiet. I saw only 3 cars in an hour or so, and so it was a pleasant stroll, with restful views of the river across overgrown meadows. By American standards, the Delaware is not a particularly imposing waterway, but it has one almost unique characteristic. It is almost the last significant undammed river in the United States. Now, this might seem an inestimable virtue, a river that runs as nature planned it. However, one consequence of its unregulated nature is that the Delaware regularly floods. In 1955, there was a flood that even now is remembered as the big one. In August of that year, ironically at the height of one of the most severe droughts in decades, 2 hurricanes hit North Carolina, one after the other, disrupting and enlivening weather all up and down the East Coast. The first dumped 10 inches of rain in 2 days on the Delaware River Valley. 6 days later, the valley received 10 inches in less than 24 hours. At a place called Camp Davis, a holiday complex, 46 people, mostly women and children, took refuge from the rising floodwaters in the camp's main building. As the waters rose, they fled first upstairs and then into the attic, but to no avail. Sometime in the night, a 30-foot wall of water came roaring through the valley and swept the house away. Amazingly, 9 people survived. Elsewhere, bridges were being brushed aside and riverside towns inundated. Before the day was out, the Delaware River would rise 43 feet. By the time the waters finally receded, 400 people were dead, and the whole of the Delaware Valley was devastated. Into this gooey mess stepped the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, with a plan to build a dam at Tox Island, very near where I was walking now. The dam, according to the Corps' plan, would not only tame the river, but allow the creation of a new national park, at the heart of which would be a recreational lake almost 40 miles long. 8,000 residents were moved out. It was all done very clumsily. One of the people evicted was blind. Several farmers had only parts of their land bought so that they ended up with farmland but no house, or a farmhouse but no land. A woman whose family had farmed the same land since the 18th century was carried from her house kicking and bellowing, to the delight of newspaper photographers and film crews. The thing about the Army Corps of Engineers is that they don't build things very well. A dam across the Missouri River in Nebraska silted up so catastrophically that a noisome blobby ooze began to pour into the town of Niobrara, eventually forcing its permanent abandonment. Then a Corps dam in Idaho failed. Fortunately, it was in a thinly populated area, and there was some warning. Even so, several small towns were washed away, and 11 people lost their lives. But these were relatively small dams. Tox Dam would have held one of the largest artificial reservoirs in the world, with 40 miles of water behind it. 4 substantial cities, Trenton, Camden, Wilmington, and Philadelphia, and scores of smaller communities stood downstream.
a disaster on the Delaware would truly be a disaster. And here was the nimble Army Corps of Engineers planning to hold back 250 billion gallons of water with notoriously unstable glacial till. Besides that, there were all kinds of environmental worries. That salinity levels below the dam would rise catastrophically, for example, devastating the ecology lower down, not least the valuable oyster beds of Delaware Bay. In 1992, after years of growing protests that spread far beyond the Delaware Valley, the dam plan was finally put on hold. But by this time, whole villages and farms had been bulldozed. A quiet, remote, very beautiful farming valley that had not changed a great deal in 200 years was lost forever. One beneficial result of the canceled project, notes the Appalachian Trail Guide to New York and New Jersey, was that the land acquired by the federal government for the National Recreation Area has provided the trail with a protected corridor. To tell you the truth, I was getting seriously tired of this. I know the Appalachian Trail is supposed to be a wilderness experience, and I accept that there are many places where it would be a shame for it to be otherwise. But sometimes, as here, the ATC seems to be positively phobic about human contact. Personally, I would have been pleased to be walking now through hamlets and past farms, rather than through some silent, protected corridor. Doubtless it is all to do with its historic impulse to tame and exploit the wilderness, but America's attitude to nature is from all sides very strange, if you ask me. I couldn't help comparing my experience now with an experience I'd had 3 or 4 years earlier in Luxembourg when I went hiking with my son for a magazine assignment. Luxembourg is a much more delightful place to hike than you might think. It has lots of woods, but also castles and farms and steepled villages and winding river valleys. The whole, as it were, European package. The footpaths we followed spent a lot of time in the woods, but also emerged at obliging intervals to take us along sunny back roads and over stiles and through farm fields and hamlets. We were always able, at some point each day, to call in at a bakery or post office, to hear the tinkle of shop bells and eavesdrop on conversations we couldn't understand. Each night we slept in an inn and ate in a restaurant with other people. We experienced the whole of Luxembourg, not just its trees. It was wonderful, and it was wonderful because the whole, charmingly diminutive package was seamlessly and effortlessly integrated. In America, alas, beauty has become something you drive to, and nature an either-or proposition. Either you ruthlessly subjugate it, as at Tox Dam and a million other places, or you deify it, treat it as something holy and remote, a thing apart, as along the Appalachian Trail. Seldom would it occur to anyone on either side that people and nature could coexist to their mutual benefit, that, say, a more graceful bridge across the Delaware River might actually set off the grandeur around it, or that the AT might be more interesting and rewarding if it wasn't all wilderness, if, from time to time, it purposely took you past grazing cows and tilled fields. I would have much preferred it if the AT guidebook had said, "Thanks to the conference's efforts, farming has been restored to the Delaware River Valley, and the footpath rerouted to incorporate 16 miles of riverside walking, because, let's face it, you can get too much of trees sometimes." Still, we must look on the bright side. If the Army Corps of Engineers had had its foolish way, I'd have been swimming back to my car now, and I was grateful at least to be spared that. Anyway, it was time to do some real hiking again. Chapter 16. In 1983, a man walking in the Berkshire Hills of Massachusetts, just off the Appalachian Trail, saw, or at least swears he saw, a mountain lion cross his path, which was a little unsettling, and even more unexpected, since mountain lions hadn't been seen in the northeastern United States since 1903, when the last one was shot in New York State. Soon, however, sightings were being reported all over New England. A man driving a back road of Vermont saw two cubs playing at the roadside. A pair of hikers saw a mother and two cubs cross a meadow in New Hampshire. Every year, there were half a dozen or more reports in similar vein, all by credible witnesses. In the late winter of 1994, a farmer in Vermont was walking across his property taking some seed to a bird feeder when he saw what appeared to be three mountain lions about 70 feet away. He stared, dumbstruck, for a minute or two, for mountain lions are swift, fierce creatures, and here were three of them looking at him with calm regard. Then he hightailed it to a phone and called a state wildlife biologist. The animals were gone by the time the biologist arrived, but he found some fresh scat, which he dutifully bagged up and dispatched to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Laboratory. The lab report came back that it was indeed the scat of Felis concolor, the eastern mountain lion, also variously and respectfully known as the panther, cougar, puma, and especially in New England, catamount. All this was of some interest to me, for I was hiking in about the same spot as that initial mountain lion sighting. I was back on the trail with a new keenness and a new plan. I was going to hike New England, or at least as much of it as I could knock off till cats came out in 7 weeks to walk with me through Maine's 100-mile wilderness. There were almost 700 miles of gorgeously mountainous Appalachian trail in New England, about a third of the AT's total trail length, enough to keep me occupied till August. To that end, I had my obliging missus drive me to southwestern Massachusetts and drop me on the trail near Stockbridge for a 3-day amble through the Berkshires. Thus it was that I was to be found on a hot morning in mid-June, laboring sweatily up a steep but modest eminence called Beckett Mountain, in a haze of repellent-resistant black flies, and patting my pocket from time to time to check that my knife was still there. I didn't really expect to encounter a mountain lion, but only the day before I had read an article in the Boston Globe about how western mountain lions, which indubitably are not extinct, had recently taken to stalking and killing hikers and joggers in the California woods, and even the odd poor soul standing at a backyard barbecue in an apron and funny hat. It seemed a kind of omen. It's not entirely beyond the realm of possibility that mountain lions could have survived undetected in New England. Bobcats, admittedly much smaller creatures, are known to exist in considerable numbers, and yet are so shy and furtive that you would never guess their existence. Many forest rangers go whole careers without seeing one, and there is certainly ample room in the eastern woods for large cats to roam undisturbed. Massachusetts alone has 250,000 acres of woodland, 100,000 in the Berkshires. From where I was now, I could, given the will and a more or less infinite supply of noodles, walk all the way to Cape Chidley in northern Quebec, 1,800 miles away on the icy Labrador Sea, and scarcely ever have to leave the cover of trees. Even so, it is unlikely that a large cat could survive in sufficient numbers to breed not just in one area, but evidently all over New England, and escape notice for 9 decades. Still, there was that scat. Whatever it was out there, it shat like a mountain lion. The most plausible explanation was that any lions out there, if lions they were released pets, bought in haste and later regretted. It would be just my luck, of course, to be savaged by an animal with a flea collar and a medical history. I imagined lying on my back, being ravaged, reading a dangling silver tag that said, "My name is Mr. Bojangles. If found, please call Tanya and Gus at 924-4667. Like most large animals, and a good many small ones, the eastern mountain lion was wiped out because it was deemed to be a nuisance. Until the 1940s, many eastern states had well-publicized varmint campaigns, often run by state conservation departments, that awarded points to hunters for every predatory creature they killed, which was just about every creature there was: hawks, owls, kingfishers, eagles, and virtually any type of large mammal. West Virginia gave an annual college scholarship to the student who killed the most animals. Other states freely distributed bounties and other cash rewards. Rationality didn't often come into it. Pennsylvania, one year, paid out $90,000 in bounties
for the killing of 130,000 owls and hawks in order to save the state's farmers a slightly less than whopping $1,875 in estimated livestock losses. It is not very often, after all, that an owl carries off a cow. As late as 1890, New York State paid bounties on 107 mountain lions. But within a decade, they were virtually all gone. The very last wild eastern mountain lion was killed in the Smokies in the 1920s. The timber wolf and woodland caribou also disappeared from their last Appalachian fastnesses in the first years of this century, and the black bear very nearly followed them. In 1900, the bear population of New Hampshire, now over 3,000, had fallen to just 50. There's still quite a lot of life out there, but it is mostly very small. According to a wildlife census by an ecologist at the University of Illinois named V.E. Shelford, a typical 10-square-mile block of eastern American forest holds almost 300,000 mammals, 220,000 mice and other small rodents, 63,500 squirrels and chipmunks, 470 deer, 30 foxes, and 5 black bears. The real loser in the eastern forests has been the songbird. One of the most striking losses was the Carolina parakeet, a lovely, innocuous bird whose numbers in the wild were possibly exceeded only by the unbelievably numerous passenger pigeon. When the first pilgrims came to America, there were an estimated 9 billion passenger pigeons, more than twice the number of all birds found in America today. Both were hunted out of existence. The passenger pigeon for pig feed, and the simple joy of blasting volumes of birds from the sky with blind ease. The Carolina parakeet because it ate farmers' fruit and had a striking plumage that made a lovely lady's hat. In 1914, the last surviving members of each species died within weeks of each other in captivity. A similar unhappy fate awaited the delightful Bachman's warbler. Always rare, it was said to have one of the loveliest songs of all birds. For years, it escaped detection. But in 1939, two birders, operating independently in different places, coincidentally saw a Bachman's warbler within 2 days of each other. Both shot the birds, nice work, boys, and that, it appears, was that for the Bachman's warbler. But there are almost certainly others that disappeared before anyone much noticed. John James Audubon's paintings included three birds, the small-headed flycatcher, the carbonated warbler, and the blue mountain warbler, that have not been seen by anyone since. The same is true of Townsend's bunting, of which there is one stuffed specimen in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. What is certainly known is that between the 1940s and 1980s, the populations of migratory songbirds fell by 50% in the eastern U.S., in large part because of loss of breeding sites and other vital wintering habitat in Latin America, and by some estimates are continuing to fall by 3% or so a year. 70% of all eastern bird species have seen population declines since the 1960s. These days, the woods are a pretty quiet place. End of Side 6.